Hello and welcome to All Things Avatar, the flagship podcast of RadioAvatar.com. This is a fan-based podcast and has no direct affiliation with James Cameron's Avatar, Fox Studios, or LearnNavi.org. So if you don't like it, don't blame anybody but us. Disclaimers, apologies, and bloopers appear at the end of every podcast. Now, on with the show.
Attention, law-abiding citizens of Earth. The signal you are receiving is not authorized.
Captain Mafrapo. Hello everyone, my name's Christy, but I'm better known throughout the Avatar community as Ting Awatikatee, or Ting for short. I'm a moderator on LearnNavi.org, and I'm in charge of the Cultural Board, where we discuss all the ins and outs of the Navi culture. Obviously, I have a deep love of studying culture, which is why I am majoring in both anthropology as well as psychology. Other than that, traveling is my life, as well as a few other nerdy hobbies. And I hope that you, my dear listeners, will learn to love all those little details Cameron has put into the Navi culture as much as I have. All right, let's get things started, and welcome to All Things Avatar.
Hey everyone, and welcome to All Things Avatar's first cultural report. Culture Corner? I don't know. Help us come up with a new name. Anyways, the thing I probably love most about Avatar is the beautiful culture of the Na'vi, or actually the Omatikaya, which is the only tribe in the film we see in great detail. According to the Activist Survival Guide, an awesome book filled with reports on Na'vi culture, Pandora flora and fauna, Omatikaya means the Blue Flute Clan, referring to the ancient blue flute they played during the most sacred of ceremonies. Not much is known about the flute other than it was a gift from Ewa, and right now we're not even sure if it survived the destruction of Home Tree, but we'll hopefully learn about it more in the next film. So with that aside, I thought today I would talk about an interesting aspect of the Na'vi culture alluded to in the movie but not fully indulge, and that, my friends, is Uniltaron, or Dream Hunt. According to the old 2007 script of the film, this was a ceremony Jake went through to become a man. We can still assume it went on behind the scenes and we just saw the end of it, when he was fully accepted into the tribe. So what is Uniltaron? Basically, the Omatikaya go into a chemically induced trance, brought about by a Pandorian insect. Yes, it's a drug. Which allows them to enter a dream plane. When under the trance, they express themselves through song as the rest of the clan sings frantically along with them. Nearly all manner of song is used, and they even utilize large hanging drums that require a Na'vi to swing on a trapeze-like device as a mallet. It's all very, very intense. And the Na'vi end up working themselves into a frenzy, and the Na'vi going under this trance will eventually meet their spirit animal, which gives them an idea of how their destiny as an adult should go. In the old script, Jake's spirit animal was Turuk, which would explain why he had any chance of taming it later in the film. I hope this was insightful to you all, and I'll bring you more culture tidbits next week. Want to discuss this topic in more detail or explore other aspects of the Na'vi culture? Come join us on the culture boards in the LearnNavi.org forums, where we always welcome a new voice.
Hi, this is Galti Palalukan, known to the outside world as Dusty White. As I am completely incapable of pronouncing Na'vi words correctly, I figured I would be the perfect spokesman for a podcast on how to learn Na'vi, right? As to who I am, I'm an author of several books, professional psychic, designer of magical toys, and I put together the world's first Na'vi fun activity book. I'm also the goofball that created Tony the Palalukan, Tautute Flakes, and the spoof of Hello Kitty, Galti Palalukan. This podcast is the latest creation, and I'm hoping that we all have a good time with it.
Shut up!
Doing a Saturday at Kellotrell on Pandora for Ultra Hunt 2.
Ultra Hunt 2.
Ultra Hunt 2. And this time we're going after Sturm Beast. Enough meat to keep the tribe fed for at least a week. And enough hide to make the clothing for 52 people.
52 people.
52 people. don't miss it at Kellutrell on Pandora. Brought to you by RDA Food Mush. We only wish it was meat.
This next segment is part of our series entitled Out on a Limb, where we bring you ideas and current activities that are at the cutting edge of Avatar fandom, far from the core trunk of simple movie viewership. This first interview is so important that I wanted to present it in our very first podcast. The people involved are doing more than chatting online. They're taking physical actions to make the world around them a better place. This intrigued me to find out why and how. I had a chance to sit down with two members of the real-life tribe that first appeared on the forums at LearnNavi.org. This group represents a dynamic example of how new concepts can change the future within our own lifetimes. The concept is a bit alien, but the fundamental human urges that impel this movement are timeless. This is the first in what I hope will be a series of interviews over time. It's pretty deep stuff, and it'll last about 15 minutes. I hope you enjoy it and find some food for thought within. I'm joined by Finua and Cizaute, members of the real-life Navi tribe. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Well, welcome. Thank you for agreeing to sit with me and talk about this. If I understand correctly, you are members of a group of people who seek to emulate the best qualities of Navi society here on Earth, such as neighborly independence, like you would see in any clan or tribe, even in small towns all across the U.S., a strong sense of community, and of course, harmony with nature. Do I have that right?
That's correct, yes. Yeah.
Let me start right in. Why did you start this tribe in the first place? What is your goal with all of this?
The way I see it is that we are all a group of like-minded people. We all joined for different reasons. Some people, there's a bit of an idea of running away from normal society. Other people just generally dislike normal society. But yeah, we're a group of like-minded people who, some after seeing Avatar and some who have always had this idea, discovered one way or another the tribe and decided to join.
That's it?
Yep.
All right. What is your goal with all of this?
The goal, ultimately, would be to have a tribe set up, open to anyone who wants to join, where as closely as possible we can replicate the values of the Na'vi tribal living.
Okay, so who is this for? Who can be in this?
There's really no sort of limit as to, we don't exclude anyone, you know, based on religion or anything, or race. It's just for anyone who really just wants to. I mean, the only things that we ask for are that you're committed, you know, discuss things with us, help us to get it established. But I mean, it really is just for anybody who wants it.
I'd like to just add to that, for legal reasons, the minimum age, it's currently being discussed, but the minimum age will be either 16 or 18, purely for the sake of legal reasons, and there may possibly be an age limit, depending on person to person.
I did just check, they have voted on 18.
Is 18, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so who will be in the tribe then? Who's going to be excluded on this?
I don't think there's one particular group that will be excluded, although I think there probably will end up being an age limit. I mean, my personal thought is that it'll be somewhere around probably 30 for the joining cutoff age, but it could be much higher depending on the person.
Okay, well, I'm 46. Am I too old to join?
That depends on what you are personally capable of doing. If you're quite happy to be able to go out and hunt for the good of others, and then I would say yes, you would be appropriate. But it is hard work. It's certainly not an easy option.
You mentioned hunt. Is this a hunter-gatherer tribe? Is this what if I had the ability to weave or grow crops?
That sort of stuff is still sort of, I mean, there's a lot that we haven't made concrete plans on. Some of the ongoing discussions are about what exactly will we do? Will we be growing crops? Will we be farming? There's quite a lot of stuff that we haven't decided yet, and there's a lot of ongoing discussion on the forum.
But your goal is a self-sustaining community.
Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. I think the roles can be broken down, really. I mean, obviously, nothing's certain yet, but it seems likely that there would be hunters, people who would cook food, possibly a certain amount of farming involved, although that hasn't been decided upon, people who make clothes, and just generally everyone would do a different thing to help contribute to the tribe as a whole.
Do you have a set model, or have you done research on previous clans and tribes to find the synchronicity of who does what that you're looking for?
We haven't really got anywhere with researching anything to speak of as yet, because we're still discussing even the continent for the location, but I think that will be something that will be considered later on.
This is in very early stages.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Nothing set in stone at this stage.
Right. Every great idea starts as a seed. This may be a bit premature to ask, but where do you plan on having the tribe? Do you have any set locations in mind? A mountain, a forest, an island?
Well, we had a lot of discussion about that. We did initially, I mean, obviously everybody was sort of wanting the jungle scene and all that, just simply because it would be appropriate, but weighing up things like diseases, how isolated you'd be, we sort of agreed it would probably be more practical that it'll be more like a forest or something. The regions we were looking at as being the best at the moment are probably South America or Oceania. Again, that might change still.
Let me take this in a different direction. What religions are involved in the tribe?
The largest single religion in the tribe is Christians. However, they only... Hang on, I've got the statistics here.
25%.
Thank you. They contribute to only 25% of the religions in the tribe as a whole. There are also quite a lot of people with no religion. There are a few atheists. And quite a lot of us follow Gaiaism, which is more or less the Earth equivalent of the religion that the Na'vi follow with Ewa. Although there are some more obscure religions that can be seen in certain tribal members. There are a number of people who follow the Jedi religion, and there is one member who follows what he calls Wolfenism.
So, how will religious freedom fit into this?
Well, the plan was pretty much just, you know, you can worship in whatever way you want. As long as you're not forcing your ideas on anybody, it's allowed, really. You know, as long as that we all just accept that we are all different and that we all have different beliefs. And it's some people were discussing the building of a place to practice worship, but again, that's not set in stone either.
Well, temples are a popular concept throughout most of society, with only scattered remains of civilizations that allow worship pretty much anywhere and everywhere. How is this different from, let's say, a religious cult?
Well, personally, I would say that this is, in fact, very dissimilar from any form of cult, because joining is very optional. There's no pressure based on it. Anyone's welcome to leave at any time. It's very much down to the individual. Whereas religious cults, there may well be brainwashing involved, and there would certainly be a lot of pressure placed on entry and exiting from it. Whereas for us, it's purely down to the individual.
What exactly is this Echo Village that I've been reading about?
Well, quite a while ago, we realized that we had quite a few interested members of the tribe who didn't actually foresee themselves as being able to live that kind of lifestyle on a permanent basis, or just switch to something so radically different. So we began to discuss the possibility of setting up an eco-village. In essence, it will be a self-sustaining village. It will be supporting the tribe, perhaps financially, you know, keeping the medical goods, keeping links to the outside world, so that we're not completely off the map if there's an accident or something goes wrong. It's really for those who want a taste of that kind of lifestyle. They will be slightly apart, maybe a mile or so, that's the idea. But the idea is that the tribe and the village, they would work in tandem to support each other.
So it's like a Navi resort, almost.
Kind of. It's like the lifestyle of the tribe, but perhaps without having to change so much about what we're used to, modern comforts and things like that. A lot of people, aren't comfortable with the idea that we will get very dirty, we will be tired, we will be hungry, possibly, if there's not enough food going around at one point. It's more just to allow more people who are interested to have some kind of, a part in this.
I was going to just say there that it's the step between the two. It's for people who would like to experience the lifestyle, but who do not want to give up the modern conveniences and luxuries that we are all very accustomed to.
I imagine you'll need to grow your own food and sew your own clothes, but since we're talking about this Echo Village, what about toothpaste and other personal hygiene issues?
For the Eco Village, my understanding was that they would have enough contact with the rest of the world to be able to buy supplies that they couldn't obtain easily. So toothpaste and other personal hygiene products could, I would have thought, be obtained. But for the tribe, I think it would be slightly different, more or less a use-what-you-can-find basis.
This is really a back-to-nature idea.
Absolutely.
So how does this differ from a hippie commune?
There are similarities. I mean, with any group of like-minded people, there is a very strong sense of community within them, which is what we're going for. But, I mean, the difference is, we really do plan on being completely back to nature. There will be absolutely, no technology that we can avoid having. So I suppose it's, in the most regard, it is more, the differences are more in the really backtracking from all the modernization that we've gone through over the last, 1,000 years or whenever.
Could I make an addition to that?
Oh, please do.
I would just like to say that for a lot of these hippie communes, it's all very friendly. It's quite easygoing, but in the tribe, it is very much a case of the strongest survive. If you can't run fast enough, then you can't catch your prey and you're going to go hungry. A lot of hippies would probably tend to be vegetarians, and I think whilst that could be plausible, I study food nutrition and I don't think it will be possible practically.
I would like to add to that that, of course, although it is very much a case of the strongest will play an active role and perhaps more active, the goal is to be self-supportive but also supportive of each other as we're going through this. It's not sort of, the idea isn't that we all go our own separate ways there. We are aiming for a very strong community.
Well, that's very admirable, and obviously that would be necessary for any project that hopes for longevity. Now, how does this compare to something like the Amish, let's say?
I have seen that comparison drawn before, and there are admittedly a number of similarities, but there are also a number of significant differences. And with the Amish society, that's more or less reverting backwards in time, if you will, for the sake of purity and moral values, which I would say is different to what we're doing, which is, it will vary to person, but I suppose for some people there would be the idea of it reverting back for religious values to be closer to Mother Earth, and for other people it would be community values.
This reminds me of something I've heard before, live-action role-playing or LARPing. How does this differ from that?
I have done on a number of occasions live-action role-playing, and I would say from experience that's very much a case of try it for a day and it will be similar to the style of what you are replicating. Whereas this is very much a case of jumping in at the deep end and actually doing all this for real. And once you're there, I'm sure it will be extremely real because there's no turning back very easily.
What kind of skills do you need to show up? If I were a member of your tribe, what do I need to bring to the table to be a valuable member of the tribe?
There are a few people on the forum interested in the tribe who really do have a great deal of knowledge and, you know, even some practice. Some people who have roughed it for a week or two just with absolutely nothing and managed to survive. But quite a lot of us don't have, you know, growing up in this modern society, we don't have these skills that we need for survive. There's a lot of talk about survival guides, people who have this experience recommending what would be a good thing to study. I mean, obviously the people who've got this experience, they intend to, you know, impart a lot of their knowledge when this finally gets going. But and a few people also think of taking, you know, courses that in survival or in food preparation, you know, things that can really help the tribe. But to begin with, we don't ask for any qualifications in specifics that you need to have before you go for this. It's just that, I mean, all that we ask is that you really think very hard before that you say you will do this, and that you really, you help us to create this. We're just asking that you're willing at this point.
When do you expect this tribe to be started up?
Well, the current outline plan, again, nothing is firmly fixed and so on, but the idea is to have it around about the 4-year mark.
The main benefit of this is that it would allow the other two Avatar films to be released in the meantime.
Okay, so you have this whole thing set up. Let's talk short run. What comes first?
Our top priority at the moment is settling on a continent for which we would want to have it. And then I think our next priority after that is to start contacting governments and looking at what we can do about land. And then after that, starting to look at survival techniques and improving fitness and so on in that manner.
If you don't have a permanent set location in mind just yet, and you've got a couple of years to develop this, are you planning in-person get-togethers or boot camps or camping trips or something that the members can do to try out this idea?
Yeah, in fact, I myself, there was an American meetup planned, a hike along, I forget exactly where in America it was, but I myself have been attempting to organize a camping trip in the UK for this year. Unfortunately, it's planned out quite well, but we're not entirely sure exactly how many people are still committed to this. But next year, we have quite a lot of people, I believe, it's 13 exactly, who have expressed a genuine interest in doing something like that. So at the moment, I've been looking into, you know, traveling and how to get people, because I mean, this would be an international sort of trip. So it's more about how do I get people from one place to another place and where do we meet. But yes, there are plenty of thoughts about having a meetup as such. Yeah.
Well, that sounds great. Now, how many people would you like to have ideally? Is this a large organization? Is this always going to be a small tribe?
Ideally, I would see about 50 people in the tribe itself, because fewer than that, and I think it would be too difficult to have enough people doing everything that's necessary, and any amount substantially more than that, and we would deplete the resources too quickly. So approximately 50 in the tribe, but I could see potentially a lot more in the eco-village.
So what happens if your tribe swells up to, let's say, 300 or 3,000? Do you break off like a beehive and people go this way or that way, or do you just get a larger plot of land?
Well, we could either get, as you said, a larger plot of land, or there was at one point a suggestion of having one tribe purely for the Americans and one for everybody from everywhere else. So we could do something along those lines, split it based on geographical location.
Now, why one tribe for the Americans?
no other reason than that simply quite a lot of people who are interested in the tribe are from America.
What if the final location were in Germany or Spain, for example?
Well, every location has pros and cons. Things that need to be considered include actually legally being allowed to live there, resources available. I don't think it will be anywhere in Europe, partly due to the climate, partly due to immigration laws and also readily available resources, and also the population of the countries. But obviously the plans will vary depending on where we finally settle for the location.
Once you're inside the tribe, you're not in the eco-village, you're out in the forest, I presume. Will everybody be speaking Navi? What about other languages?
Well, there has been a discussion about this. Quite a lot of people do want to speak Navi, and they are learning, but obviously, you know, this is by far, I wouldn't even say it was a second priority. I mean, it's great for a community spirit and that sort of sense, but it's more important to get other things that, you know, such as survival techniques and that down before we consider that. It might be a long-term goal that we could think about setting up after everything's established. It really depends on the rate of people's learning on the side. But, I mean, if people come and don't speak it, it's not like we're going to say, you can't come in. I mean, if we have to speak in English, that's fine. Other languages, thus far, there are various members from different countries. I speak to people from France and Belgium and Denmark, but they all do speak good English. So at this point, it hasn't come up as a problem.
Okay, so tell me about day-to-day life. I wake up, I eat some berries, now what?
The daily activities would obviously depend on what role you play as part of the tribe. I think hunters could potentially be out for multiple days at a time because of tracking the prey. But if you were a cook, then you'd probably stay in the campsite all day.
What about parents and family? Exactly what do you tell them? Mom, Dad, I'm going to live in the mountains with Bambi?
There are quite a lot of different approaches to this. It is something that we do discuss, obviously, in many of the forums. I mean, the average age of members at the moment, although this will be 4 years' time, is between 16 to 19, although there are, you know, obviously a lot of other people. I'm sure we've got 40-year-old some people as well, but everybody has a different approach. I've read some people who plan to write letters, some people who just plan to tell them straight off at some point, or other people who really just want to leave it last minute and then just say, that's what I'm going to do. Personally, for myself, I've been introducing the topic of why I want to do it, helping my parents to understand exactly the reasoning behind it, that it isn't something that I'm just decided randomly after perhaps a 2-month spell that I'm going to do. I want them to understand the reasoning behind why I want to do this.
How isolated from society do you intend to be?
We do intend to be fairly isolated, of course. I mean, that's part of why we want to do it for, if not everyone, then at least the majority of people. There is somebody who probably this would be for the eco village who's bringing or plans to bring their own helicopter that they own. So the idea is we will be, you know, not in contact with people, but through the eco village we'll be able to maintain that contact with the outside world if you so choose. And we don't intend to be in a place that we bump into lots of people, but equally we don't want to be so far away that if something goes wrong, such as a medical emergency, I mean, we want to be within easy access to a hospital, you know, fairly quickly. So that's something that we have to consider while we're picking a location, that we're not too isolated and equally we're not too close to civilization.
Well, there you have it. I want to thank you for joining me, and I hope that we get to hear from you over the time as your plans develop.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd just like to say thank you for the opportunity you've given us to tell you about this.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing how this progresses.
Here is Vern Smith with an important announcement.
Welcome, valued customer. This is Peter, your local technical and corporate advisor, and if you've got any questions regarding the RDA or technology in general, go ahead and ask. It might be that I'm able to give you some non-classified answer.
Before you can even begin to think to step on board the ISV and head for Pandora, daydreamers, you got to develop a strong mental attitude regarding the technology that you will be in contact with. Today's briefing is on that large behemoth of a vessel you will unknowingly call home for the next 6 years. Love it now, because it will only feel like minutes when you're on board. Some of you may ask, what is the ISV? Well, like I said, it's that big freaking spaceship you got going on up there that's going to take you to Pandora. What else do you want to know?
Well, ISV. What does ISV stand for anyway?
Really? They didn't teach you this in the briefing? The other briefing? You know, the intro briefing?
Hey, I'm on the blue people side.
Fine. The ISV stands for Interstellar Vehicle. That means between stars. Cool. Next person? Anybody?
What kind of gas does it run on? Unleaded? Diesel?
You kidding me? Gas? What
is
are we,
a
back
hybrid?
In the 20th century or something? What are we doing, driving our Model Ts now again? Come on.
Well, it can't run on
a pentium. You of all people should know, Mr. Scientist over there, Mr. Avatar Driver, that the thing works on fusion matter and antimatter engines, you know?
Well, that wasn't really explained in the movie now, was it?
No?
Oh, snap.
That wasn't. Well,
sorry.
Okay, fine. We know what ISV stands for now. Are there just one of them? Do they go out to Pandora and then they turn around so they're gone for 12 years, or do they have more than one? I mean, that thing looks really expensive.
Well, yeah, it is really expensive. We don't know specifically how much it costs, but they actually do have upwards of 12 different vehicles that go and travel between Pandora and Earth. Out of those, 9 of them are actually of the same star class or same class of vehicle that the Venture Star is, which is called the Capital Star class by the RDA. And supposedly one can conject that if you have 12 vehicles, you're going to be putting them on some sort of rotation that has at least 2 or 3 traveling en route back and forth while the others are sitting unloading and reloading getting ready for the next trip. I mean, even the Venture Star itself, when in the movie, it's on its second trip.
Well, how big is this thing? I mean, you see it according to the planet or moon or whatever, and it looks pretty big.
Well, yeah, it's a pretty big vessel to go that far.
Give me something to go by. Is it a mile long? Is it a 25 feet long? I mean, do we know anything about it?
Yeah, it's actually given to us within the Activist Survival Guide and on various websites on the internet, Pandorapedia for one, and then a whole bunch of other Wikipedias that people have put together. By the way, if you're ever going to go research any of these projects, make sure you research all the websites and then take all the common information together. Don't just go off one. You're going to get screwed. But what we can get from the ISV is that it's actually 1.6 kilometers long.
And how long is that in, like, American language?
That's about a mile long. 1 mile long ship. So if you live anywhere in a gridded city, that's about the time it takes for you to go from one light to another. It would take you to go for the length of the ship. And then
if you could drive your car in the ship.
Well, yeah, if you could drive
the
car.
You had to walk it for a lot longer.
Definitely. And it's about 330 meters high. That's about That's about a football field, yeah. It's a little over a football field in length and just under a football field in height, about 218 meters. So this is a pretty big ship. It's no small expenditure to make one of these.
Okay, so we know that a lot of people are sleeping during the 6-year trip. Who's driving, and where are they during this time? What are they doing?
Okay, well, the thing is that the RDA went back on studies back in, according to what the Activist Survival Guide says, that they actually went studies back in the 21st century, NASA studies and whatnot, that people could not stay awake and in confined spaces like you would be on a spaceship for longer than 14 months. So to anticipate this, since the trip is actually almost six years long, they have a crew of 25 separate technicians that are cross-trained to do everything and anything on the ship that requires human interaction. And what they do is they work in shifts of five for 14 months at a time. So you'll have a five-man crew that starts out the flight, they get everybody into their cryos, and then, boom, everybody's off, gone, the thing's cruising. About 14 months down the road, they'll wake up the next crew, that crew will go to sleep, and then the next shift will take over for the next 14 months, and then that whole cycle keeps going until they hit Pandora.
Where do they stay while they're awake? I mean, like, you gotta get exercise or something.
Yeah, you do, and it definitely does get boring in space. You talk to any astronaut nowadays, they are usually doing tons of busy work. But if you remember in the movie, when it's doing the pan over of the Venture Star, if you remember those two pods that are kind of spinning around the center of the ship, that's actually where the crew stays while the ship's in transit. That being the reason why it's spinning is because it can provide for them some level of artificial gravity while they're in space cruising, and then also it contains different things for them to be able to live off of. Like, it actually has an indoor garden, so they can have fresh fruits and vegetables along with their frozen dried foods to eat.
So you gotta be able to fix stuff and garden at the same time.
Yeah, these guys know what they're doing. Green thumbs with the bent-up pinky from hammering. You gotta know what's up.
Well, that's pretty cool. So you're saying that the spinning creates like a centrifugal force, which is a pretend or artificial gravity.
Yeah, it's one of the theories that scientists have nowadays that causes our gravity here on Earth, and it's because of our spinning. Nobody really knows for sure what causes gravity, but we do know that. I mean, you think about it. In school, you play tetherball, or you have a long ball on the end of a rope. You spin that ball around, and it's going to pull on your arm, and that's creating centrifugal force on the end of the ball. So while it's pulling on your arm, there's a form of gravity there on the end of the ball. It's the same process for spinning those two pods around. It's going to create centrifugal force pushing outwards, allowing the crew to stand up and walk around just like they were on Earth.
Right, as long as you're on the inside of the ball, so to speak, you're going to be pushed to the floor. Now, that's all cool, but what is that giant mirror? It looked really pretty, but is that thing functional or is that just art?
Actually, it has a lot of function to it. To clarify, that mirror thing is that big, I guess, polygonal reflective mirror that they do a pan over shot over the Venture Star, and they're actually looking at the reflection of Pandora into it. That mirror has two functions. See, when the Venture Star leaves Earth and heads towards Pandora, it doesn't use its engines to build the speed up to get there. What it actually does is it deploys this huge, massive solar sail, which is like a big, huge sail for ships on water today. But instead of working with wind, it catches all the light particles sent off from like the sun or anything else that provides light. And that's what pushes the ship in that direction. And what happens is on Earth, they have a high lasered photon or high powered photon laser, which fires large amounts of photon particles at the solar sail, which then propels it up to its traveling speed of 70% of the speed of light. But the thing is, with that amount of laser beam and light heading towards the ship, it's going to nuke the rest of the ship. So they have that mirror there to protect the rest of the ship while that laser is being fired at the solar sail. Its second function is when it's in flight, when the ISB Venture Star is in flight, it actually does a 180 flip. It flips over. And so the mirror's in front when it's heading towards Pandora. And then it releases the mirror, which travels out to 1,000, 10,000, don't know, doesn't say specifically, kilometers in front of the Venture Star. So while it's traveling at 70% of the speed of light, it actually moves out in front of the Venture Star too and acts as a sort of shield against small spatial debris, like small grains of sand or something of that sort that's just floating around out there in space, so it doesn't tear up the ship if it hits it, and that acts as a sort of deflection shield.
Yeah, that was one of my problems with Star Wars, was when they're going to hyperspace, I'm thinking, what if they just happen to run into a pebble, you know, or a giant rock? And the same thing here with 70% of light speed, or whatever they're calling it. What if you hit a grain of dust? So you're saying this mirror thing is kind of a shield for the rest of the ship then?
Yeah, the mirror actually has four separate layers to it. The mirrors themselves are more than a few molecules thick, but they work in a sort of series system where if the first one gets hit by the debris, like, they say that there's not that much debris out there and the chances of it are really slim to none, but with the amount of travel that the ISVs are putting in between Pandora and Earth, it's still likely that they're going to hit something at least once over their lifetime. So what they did is they designed this mirror shield that has four separate layers of mirrors so that when the first one gets hit, it vaporizes the dust into a plasma form, which then the second one absorbs, and then if it goes through that one, then the third one absorbs, and then if it finally goes through that one, the fourth one absorbs, and by that point it's going to dissipate into practically nothing that's going to be able to hurt the ship. So it protects that, and plus if you have a ship that hits the dust particles like that, it's going to be quicker, it's going to be gone quicker than Admiral Akbar can say it's a trap.
Now, I've got another question. At the very beginning of the movie, we see the ISV and it's coming at us. Now, if I understand, space is really, really cold. Yet, There's these two giant glowing things. It looks like they're red hot on the ship. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, those are actually the heat sinks for the engine. Now, like I was saying earlier, the engine is an antimatter-matter reaction. So pretty much, if you've ever read Angels and Demons before, he kind of explains it in there. You got antimatter and matter. Antimatter is essentially the other side of the equation for matter. If you put the two together, they annihilate each other. It's like finding the ends of the both sides of the equation. It makes it equal, but in this case, they annihilate and turn into huge amounts of energy, which where unobtainium comes in. When it creates the amount of energy, this high amount of energy, the unobtainium, being a superconductor, uses all of its forces of magnetism to funnel all that power and all that energy into a beam that fires behind the ship, causing thrust. Now, of course, this causes huge amounts of heat to come from this, and so these giant heat sinks suck up all that heat from it. But the interesting thing about it is that those heat sinks will glow for 2 or 3 weeks before they finally cool off.
So how do the engines work?
Well, the engines, like I was saying, they're fusion of antimatter and matter. In this case, they use anti-hydrogen atoms, which are stored at a near-perfect vacuum, and they're cooled to almost absolute zero. So, like, there's little gravity affecting it, period, and there's almost no heat at all. Like, it's absolute zero. It's not cold, it's not hot, it's just right there in the middle where there's nothing. And what happens is they combine the matter to the antimatter, like I said, makes huge amounts of energy, and then they plume it out the back of an exhaust to create a thrust. Cool thing is, have you ever looked at a a welding arc before and had to wear those glasses to look at it?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've looked at them, but I haven't worn the glasses.
Well, that would explain the reason why you're wearing glasses. But the light that's created from this reaction that the engine creates is over a million times brighter than a welding arc. And the exhaust plume that goes behind it is over 30 kilometers long. To give you an example, I mean, if you knew anything about where I live, that's how long it is from me to get to Phoenix here. And that's a pretty good long drive to get there. 30 kilometers, that's...
So you're saying this is bright enough and long enough that you could almost see it from Earth if the ship was close enough?
Oh, yeah. They always say that it's the greatest man-made spectacle known to man at that point. That huge exhaust plume that it creates, it's ridiculous how bright it is. Like, it literally burn your retina if you're looking at it. Like,
it's
straight
just
gone.
Brighter, bright as the sun at noontime.
In space.
In space. And it's a lot closer than the sun. Well, the mission time is actually 14.5 years long. And this comes from the amount of time it takes to get the ship going, get the ship, how long it takes in cruise, get the ship there, how long it stays there, and then get the ship going, coming back in cruise, and then decelerating to finally make its way back to Earth. Like, it doesn't just hit a button and jump to light speed, just like you see in Star Wars and Star Trek. It actually takes a while to get to its cruising speed of 70%, the speed of light, which, by the way, is upwards of 210,000 kilometers per second, or 130 miles per second. 130,000 miles per second. So that's moving pretty quick.
130 miles per second is slower than...
Yeah.
So the summary of that is, from the time the ship leaves Earth to when it comes back to Earth is about 14 and a half years. Earth, in Earth years, but it only feels like six.
Yeah. If anybody knows anything about relativistic times, that's Einstein's little equation equals mc squared. The thing is, when you move closer to the speed of light, the effects of time are lessened on you. Time is a weird conceptual thing which does not need to be gone into, but when you're moving at that speed of that close to the speed of light, the effects of time and space upon yourself, your person, and the materials of the ship are actually lessened in conjunction to real time that's actually going on. So, like it says, or like it is, you go 14.5 years spent total going back and forth between Pandora, but it really only feels to yourself like you've aged only 6 years.
Okay, I understand that.
Now, during that trip, what happens if the cryo tanks fail?
Well, you see, we're dealing with a corporation here that's in it for the money. They're in it for the money. And when they built these ISVs, they built them to min-max the living crap out of how much materials they can put on the ship to transport there. This includes the crew and the supplies needed to keep the working crew alive, like the ones that are operating the ship. So they only packed enough food and enough water, maybe a little extra more, to keep those people alive. If something happens and the cryo tanks for all the other passengers, like your miners, your RDA security people, your Avatar drivers, your scientists, well, plain and simple, before you wake up, you're dead. They euthanize you right there on the spot. You don't even get a chance to say anything.
It's also highly efficient.
It is very efficient, too, because you got to think about it. When you sign on as an employee of the RDA, there's got to be some sort of waiver that you got to sign to, or a little clause in a contract saying the mission's more important than you. At that point in the mission, when you're on the ship already, the ship cannot turn around. you are going to be killed to save the interest of the mission.
Do you have to pee in cryosleep?
Nope. Cryo, your body is literally frozen. It stops. For 6 years or 5 years, 9 months and 24 days, as it says in the movie. It has minor functions to it, but really it's frozen within itself.
Like a turkey. So they just have to thaw you out like a Christmas turkey.
Exactly.
Wow. I don't know if going to Pandora is worth being frozen.
You're as valuable as a turkey, too, when it comes to waking up unexpectedly.
Well, yeah. Look how easily Jake's brother was replaced.
I know.
Oops, dinner's spoiled.
So I say it's time for a song.
Oh, come on. No. Why are we going to do that? Okay, no, look, everybody.
This is one, cruel.
Two, oopie, oopie. Everybody now.
What was that?
Oh my god, that was awful. I'm gonna vomit. I mean, really, really bad. Radio Avatar.
It was like a terrible nightmare. Even now, I sometimes wake from a dream and find myself shaking from the memory of it.
Not necessarily. I had some theories.
Nope. Avatar 2 won't even take place in Pandora.
So if I made a tiny little film that nobody saw, do you think I could win an Oscar just for the sake of getting an audience?
I don't think it works quite.
Could try that, no?
Could try it. You may win a Sundance Film Festival Award.
Anything I can get. Avatar at the Oscars, did it get screwed?
I would say yes, it did.
Is already.
Wait, didn't we say we weren't going to do nerd talk where only we know what's going on?
Oh yeah, let's back it up. Like right between your eyebrows, and then draw it away.
Oh, like I've got a headache. I can't stand this.
Yeah, kind of like I have a headache.
This podcast just goes on forever.
Contact us. It's not like we're going to tell you where we live or anything, but you can email us at podcast@allthingsavatar.com or just pick anybody's name and send it to them at allthingsavatar.com.